A great workout deserves a great reward. Treat yourself right with new coconut smoothie bowls made with fresh fruit, Purely Elizabeth granola, and now creamy coconut. You earned it. Grab a treat you can feel good about only at Smoothie King.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you listen to this show, you'll know that I'm always excited about the possibilities of the future, including AI, despite all the problems with it. But a lot of people feel underwhelmed by their interactions with ChatGPT. And so I've created a workshop that I'll be touring the country with to help people to get started with AI. The first two workshops are in Dublin on the 26th and 30th of September. They're in Ballsbridge and Dunleary. They're super practical. You'll learn lots of stuff about how to get things done. Find out more and get tickets at getstartedai.com. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about how to bring someone back from death. Not near death, but actually a couple of hours dead. The amazing Sam Parnia, who is an expert in resuscitation, will be talking to us about the frontiers of research that literally is bringing people back to life. Fascinating stuff. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Shane, our first story has to do with clocks.
Yes. How precise do we need the clock to be? You know, I thought about this a lot during the Olympics, right? How accurate the clock needs to be for the 100 meter sprint and how they know when to go, how they're going to start it. Precision is important, not just here, but in lots of areas. And so scientists can do experiments using time to however precise they can make a clock. And so in Boulder, Colorado, in a big tower called Gila, place I've been many times, they have all the best physicists in the world working on time. It's incredible. And they built something called a nuclear clock, or the components of a nuclear clock. We've spoken before about atomic clocks on the program.
Wait, this is an atomic clock?
No. So atomic clocks use a resonance within atoms, right? So atoms have electrons, and electrons have what we call energy levels. So you can get these transitions between them. There can be a frequency to that, and you can use that frequency to define a clock. That's okay. How the second is actually defined, using a cesium ion. They are precise to 19 decimal places. So the best atomic clock at the moment loses 1 second every 40 billion years. And so you'd wonder, why would physicists want to build an even more accurate clock? But they do, partially because they can, and for other reasons, like so they can do better experiments. And so
I guess when you talk about things that are really, 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 really small, or things that are really, 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 really big, you
fast,
kind of need
really, really, really fast, or where the difference between the 0.00001 or 0.0000015 would matter, right? So they use a nucleus, and they use an isotope of thorium-229. And what they do is they excite it with a laser, right? So they get a laser and they fire it at the nucleus of thorium. And instead of exciting the atom, they excite the nucleus. So there are energy levels within the nuclei of atoms, and you can excite and de-excite within that, and you can use that to sort of set another clock. So the frequency here of light is associated with the shifting of energies, and it's at the moment, it's 100,000 times more precise than the atomic clock, right? So
I never get this. If we have the most precise clock in the world already, how can we know the next one's more precise if we don't have anything to measure with it? Like if the thing we measure it with is not as precise,
yeah.
How can we know it's more precise?
I suppose they must have to. Actually, I don't.
Right?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. That's driving me mad now. How do they know how accurate
and
it is?
And does it not change the definition of a second?
I know, because the frequency of the energy transition is such that they're able to know that it is that precise, because the time comes from the energy transition, right? So the time interval is defined by the energy difference between the two levels within the nucleus. So in other words, that's set and that's knowable. So if you're able to accurately make that transition happen, then you'd know how precise the clock is.
And that's why we have you in the program.
I hope that's right.
Shut up. Why would you say that? Why would you? We did it.
Because
and then you just
many physicists
don't
listening.
Row back on it, man. God. Our second story, Ruth, has to do with depression.
Yeah, all about the brain today. So this is new research from Weill Cornell University and a big international team, over 30 different researchers. And what they found is that there's a particular region, a particular network in the brain, which seems to be significantly larger in people who suffer from depression. So when you think about the brain, particularly when you think about maybe school physiology or school biology, you know, we see the brain divided into different kind of lobe areas, you know, and there's sort of physical structures that we see inside the brain, which obviously are our way of visualizing what's going on. But as well as those distinct lobes, the brain is also divided into different networks.
Systems,
and they cross over the different structures that we talk about. And what they found here, there's one network called the salience network. And as the name suggests, it helps our brains to kind of pick out what's relevant or what's salient. So it helps us to kind of filter out noise. But because it helps us pick out things that are very relevant to us, it's constantly scanning the environment for things like threats, because those are very relevant, but it's also very focused on things like rewards. So what they did was they put a whole series of people into MRI machines, and they looked at the activity in their brain. So they took 141 people with depression and 37 people without it, and they measured the size of all these different brain networks. And what they found was the frontostriatal salience network, so this particular part of this network, was on average 73% bigger on patients with depression.
Now, these networks, they are, I mean, I suppose they are more dynamic than the physical structure, right? So is it not expected that we would find, you know, essentially activity? Is it different to activity? Or is it, you know, when you talk about this network, are you talking about something you can physically touch and measure, or are we talking about activity? Because I would have assumed it would have been different in people who have depression.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, it's interesting because it is activity, but it is related activity that gives a signature of a functional physical network. But they had other data that they were able to look back on. So they had single kind of brain scans from nearly 1,000 healthy people and 300 people with depression. They were able to validate that, but they were also able to look at children who went on to develop depression in later life. So they had scans from 57 children, and they found even before there were any symptoms of depression, these children had enlarged areas in their brain. And that's what's really fascinating about this study, because it's sort of suggesting that this expanded brain network could actually be a risk factor for depression, as opposed to, as you might think, you know, depressive activity behavior, you know, being manifest in the brain because of repeated types of behavior.
Right. So this is something that exists before anyone gets in a clinical diagnosis. So it could be a biomarker essentially for depression.
Exactly. And I mean, that's where the authors are saying, you know, this can be very helpful for people who might understand that there is a physical predisposition. And of course, they're even speculating to say, is there any way that the size of this area could potentially be prophylactically shrunk? I mean, obviously that...
What do you mean prophylactically?
Well, in advance of any depression kind of manifesting, you know, could you do something with it? So yeah, very, very interesting study on these neural networks.
Thank you. Our third story, Shane, has to do with dogs again.
Yeah, brainy dogs.
Yeah.
And collies, of course. And we've spoken about this group in Hungary in the Eötvös Loránd University many times because they do great work. I'd love to go on sabbatical if they're listening. And they've written a piece in BioLetters where they've shown that dogs can remember the names of toys where there's been at least a 2-year gap after seeing the toy. So they can, in other words, they have a long-term memory for the names of toys that they love. So we've seen before how collies can learn the names of over 1,000 objects. We spoke about one called Chaser, who was able to distinguish between different objects. And in this study, they took 5 dogs who learned the names of 12 toys. The toys were then put away for 2 years and they took them back out. It said in the paper that some of the toys went missing, and I wondered, did the dogs find them or what? It would be a funny story aside there. But they allowed the dogs to inspect the toys after they were taken out after 2 years, to kind of have a look at them. And then the owners placed the toys around the house in different places. And they told the dogs, can you go and get, you know, object A, B, C, etc., one at a time. And they found that dogs got the correct toy 44% of the time on average, which is above chance. And
what?
Some dogs, yeah, some like for all of them, right? So, and some dogs got the whole thing right 60% of the time. So I just think it's incredible.
What's chance? What would the chance number be?
If there was 4 toys and they...
Exactly, 50% of the time multiplied by 50, so it'd be 25, 12 and a half, etc. Yeah, so
give me the answer.
I don't know.
But they have a one this is why I get you on, because you're smart.
Four toys. They have a one in four chance of getting the right one.
Some dogs had four, some dogs had more, so it would depend on the dog. Yeah. But they were
more research required.
Yeah, no, they were really good at it. And I love the line, the more time you invest in your dog, the more you get back in your in the relationship with the dog. Now, you've dissed
your dog.
What's
that got to do with?
Because they're basically saying, it's like, instead of thinking that these dogs and these studies are just like somehow Sheldon Cooper dogs, it's that all dogs are actually quite trainable and will do it if you invest the time in training them spending time
and
with them.
And they're remembering things.
Yes.
So they're going to remember things.
They remember your bad behaviour.
Just very clear, I'm very good to my dog. Just to be very clear, just doing that with your dog doesn't necessarily mean that they want to do that. You're doing that with
dogs.
Them.
Do want to do it. Dogs are the sort of animal that they are so happy.
As a physicist, you are very, very confident in this.
No,
in this
I know
moment.
This for certain, that dogs and horses are the sorts of
this
animals
is very
that love
confrontational
to work.
Confrontational news round. Can yes. I say?
It's always
he's asking me hard questions that I don't know the answers.
Yeah. Ruth, our final story is about learning.
It's about birds. So
oh, I like that.
On the animatronic. So yeah, I mean, this is about birds learning new tricks. Old birds learning new tricks. And this, you know, we might all be familiar with that idea that as your brain gets a bit older, it seems harder to learn new things, old dogs, new tricks. And we think this is because our brains lose plasticity that we have in the early stages of our life. And the question here from researchers in the Max Planck Institute of Biological Intelligence, which was published in Nature Communications, is what if we could turn back the clock? And they used zebra finches, who are a little bird that have a very beautiful song repertoire. But that song repertoire is learnt in the first 90 days of the bird's life. And after that, it's kind of hardwired into their brain and they don't learn any new songs. But there's a type of neuron that is in our brain called an inhibitory neuron, which kind of acts to, I suppose, punctuate our brain waves and what's going on in our brain and sort of act as a control. And we know it's probably part of our memory formation. But what they decided to do was see if these inhibitory neurons are kind of stopping that new learning, or do they have a role in stopping that new learning? So they were able to switch off some of these inhibitory neurons in the birds in a very specific way. So they used
optogenetics
using light, and they also used drugs as well administered to the birds. And the results were pretty remarkable. So they exposed the birds to new tunes, and the birds very quickly started picking them up in a way that they weren't doing if they didn't have this intervention. And it didn't affect their memories of their existing songs. So they were still able to sing those, but they also learned the new ones. So,
wow. I mean, that sounds like it could be quite useful in humans, could it not?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things about inhibitory neurons is that we know that they are dysregulated in many, many conditions of the brain. So they're very, very interesting from that perspective. But of course, this idea that as we age, our brains become less plastic, and maybe it might be simpler to turn that switch than we thought. But this is the first time this kind of expansion of learning has been seen in this way. So again, it is very, very interesting.
It's a pretty big study, isn't it? When you think about it, like the potential for that, I could learn what electricity is. That'd be huge.
And while Ruth was doing that, I have figured out the chance thing. So if a dog has one in five options, a chance would just be that it just gets like one in five, right? So
So it's actually very easy.
No, it's not. They're not. They're really clever.
No, you made the maths more complicated.
I did.
I did say one and four.
She did. Ruth did have it right, and I didn't listen because I was fighting with you.
Well, let's fight again next week, shall we? Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland. Thanks so much. Now, life after death has been the subject of religious discourse and indeed fiction for millennia. But somewhat bizarrely among modern medical researchers, it has become sort of an accepted reality. So what does this profound discovery mean for critical care and resuscitation, and indeed for our sense of when someone is alive or dead? Sam Parney is Director of Critical Care and Resuscitation Research at the New York University School of Medicine and author of Lucid Dying, The New Science Revolutionizing How We Understand Life and Death. He joins me now. Sam, great to have you on the program again. If you wouldn't mind just maybe starting off telling me about the work that you're doing with people and how you get access to human beings who are on the brink of death or technically dying.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back. You know, I'm an intensive care physician, and my specialty is trying to resuscitate, in other words, restart the heart in people who would otherwise be declared dead, and essentially bring them back to life and preserve their organs and their brains so they can have a meaningful recovery. You have to remember It's estimated that almost 70 million people die every year, and of those, close to 9 million just die from heart attacks. So many people who die actually die from a potentially reversible medical condition like a heart attack, but they stay dead because the only treatments we have to offer them after their heart stops is simple CPR, which is really outdated. It's almost 70 years old. And so what we're working on is developing new methods to try to restart the heart and preserve the brain after people die. And we can do that because science has discovered that contrary to the way that society and most people perceive death, in other words, we think of death as lights out. We think of when the heart stops and someone's died. That is a rapid degeneration from 100 to zero with nothing left. And the reality is actually after we die, incredibly, the body goes through a hibernation-like of state where actually this lasts many hours of time. So if we can relabel death and remove that end and think of it as a treatable condition, we can restore life to many tens of millions of people in the coming decades.
Sorry, you said hours after someone's heart has stopped, you can potentially reverse that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the scientific basis by which we are operating. And I can give you some evidence of that. Again, I realize this is very challenging for people because we've been conditioned to think of life and then there's a binary death and we think they're totally separate. And once you label somebody death, that is the absolute end. But it really isn't. For instance, in 2019, a group of researchers at Yale University took 32 pig brains. These were decapitated pig heads from a slaughterhouse. These were not experimental animals. These were animals who were killed for their meat. But instead of discarding those brains, they took them to the lab 4 hours after the animals had been killed. Now, again, you can't be more dead than decapitated dead. And they, right? And they, so, but I mean, it's not a play with words. We're not talking about the process leading to death. We're talking about death and post-mortem beyond death. So they took these and then they connected them to a catheter and then they gave them a combination of medications that preserves the brain and organs better. And they were able to, they did that over up to 10 hours. And they were able to restore brain function in all 32 brains. So the brains came back to life after death, right? And that's the premise. And then what they ended up doing in 2022...
Sorry. Decapitated pig's brains 4 hours later came back to life in what way, Sam? Like just you got a little bit of electricity or actually...
No. Every function that they tested came back. Every component of the brain was restored. There was no damage to the brains whatsoever.
What? Absolutely. But what about this idea that when our heart stops and we start getting oxygen to the brain, we get tissue death and atrophy? And what about all that?
That's a great point you bring up. So you see, we have been mistakenly taught as doctors, and this is disseminated to the public, that after the heart stops and the brain is deprived of oxygen, the brain becomes permanently damaged after only 5 or 10 minutes. Mm. But that is totally incorrect. And that is what has prevented progress in this area. What's now been discovered is that after 5 or 10 minutes, so it's nuanced. Yes, after 5 or 10 minutes of oxygen deprivation, the process of cell damage leading to cell death starts, but it doesn't end for hours, possibly days. And that's why I said when we die, our brain and our organs go into a hibernation-like state. If you leave us alone, ironically, the damage that occurs is when doctors resuscitate, they do CPR. When you put oxygen back into that mix, the oxygen becomes toxic and then it accelerates cell death. But what it really means is that we've identified a window where we can treat this oxygen-mediated injury, which is what the group at Yale did. And they were able to show perfectly that you can restore total function to brains hours post-mortem.
There's a movie with Steve Martin in it called The Man with Two Brains, in which he is a disembodied brain. And in it, he's obviously conscious of it. What about these pigs? Did they know that they were alive and yet didn't have any sense of where their body was or where they were? Like what happens there?
Well, one of the key things that these researchers, and I want to highlight, this was published in the top medical journal, scientific journal called Nature. This is top research. It was actually recognized as one of the breakthroughs of the year. Now, these researchers were rightly very concerned that these pig brains may become conscious again. And what they did, which was extremely smart, one of the drugs that they gave that helped preserve the brain and prevent damage had a side effect that essentially causes deep sedation of the brain. So essentially, although they got electricity emerging, as you expect, but because of this medication, they were able to prevent signs of total consciousness.
Right.
And in these ways. So it's a bit like you and I go to... Exactly.
Right.
And
okay.
So of course, if you were to remove the drug, then most likely consciousness would have been restored. But at least they could guarantee there was no pain or suffering for the pigs,
right,
for the brains.
Wow. So it's very difficult, I suppose, for us to then kind of think about what this process might do to humans. Is it dangerous to be thinking about that sort of procedure? I mean, obviously not with severed heads, but with people who have died. What are the ethical implications if we have the ability to perform something like this on humans? Is it possible we bring back people who are severely mentally ill or mentally damaged? How do we advance this research without putting real people in risk of sort of a horrible limbo?
Well, I see it completely the opposite, actually, because what this has proven is that you can take people. Think of all the young people who die, let's say athletes who die and are pronounced dead. Think of all the news stories every day where people are pronounced dead, otherwise healthy individuals who were stabbed, who ran into accidents. Think of all the, say, middle-aged men who die out of a sudden heart attack. All those, what these scientists were able to show is that those people who are truly dead, their organs are salvageable if you can initiate the right treatments instead of giving up. Today, society gives up because they label it the end, but that's not true anymore.
Hmm.
And so actually what the Yale scientists did, incredibly, 3 years after that, in 2022, they went a step further. They took what they had developed and they enhanced it and they combined it with a sort of a heart-lung bypass machine that is able to flow blood better, and they connected up to dead pigs. 1 hour after the pigs had been killed, this is not just the brain now, it's the whole body. And they were able to show that they compared that to the best of the best that's available in hospitals. And they were able to show that over 6 hours, they could restore function in all the vital organs, including the brain, the heart, you know, kidney, liver, everywhere. And so while they were concerned about the ramifications for society, because essentially, if you can restore life to all the organs, you've restored life to a dead mammal, to a pig. And that is now the challenge that we have, is to initiate the same thing in humans who are otherwise being declared dead, who have a meaningful life ahead of them. So I'm not talking about people who've got untreatable diseases, let's say cancer that's spread all over their body and their organs are all totally damaged and there are no treatments for them. But I'm talking about the many millions of people all over the world who die prematurely and who are otherwise in good health, that could be revived. So that is what we are trying to establish today.
So where is that research at? I mean, are there machines that we could use today to get someone who's had a heart attack and died on scene? The paramedics put them in the ambulance. A couple of hours later, we can hook them up to something and they could come back fully? Like, how far away are we from that? And what sort of technology do you need for it?
I think at this point, you know, we need to take baby steps before we can run. But I think the potential is there for certainly a couple of hours after somebody has died. Right now, I think where we're looking at is up to an hour to start with. And the machines exist because what the Yale scientists did was, there was nothing extraordinary in the sense that it was extraordinary, but it wasn't. They took essentially what are heart-lung bypass machines that are available and are used all over the world. But they combined it with a cocktail, a combination of brain protective medications. And these are all available, cheap. Things like magnesium, things like an antibiotic called minocycline. But these all have organ-preserving properties if you use them. So they created this by looking at the science and putting it together, and they were able to show that it works. So we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to put the pieces together that are currently available, but use them correctly. And that is what we are currently trying to do at my institution in New York.
If you just joined us, we're speaking to Sam Parnia. He's an expert in near-death and death experiences. He's written a book called Lucid Dying. Some of the stuff that you're saying, like, How fringe are you considered, or and are these Yale researchers considered? Because you talked about this being published in Nature. That's pretty huge. But what you're saying to me is just, it flies in the sense of everything, you know, I've been told about death and everything I think of when I've been around death, and the idea that that could be reversible and that we could do that potentially just seems so out there. Like, do you get a lot of criticism from, you know, neurosurgeons or heart surgeons who say, look, we can't do this. They disagree with what you're suggesting.
I don't think any of this is fringe at all. I think that all of us, our doctors, our responsibility is try to push the boundaries of our fields. I'm an expert on resuscitation. That is something I've been working on, studying for more than 30 years. And there are many other experts like myself. And we have all come to recognize, and actually we come fed up of the use of continued use of only CPR, which is almost 70 years old. There's nothing else in medicine that we're still practicing as we did almost 70 years ago. It's almost embarrassing. And we're tired of seeing the awful statistic where only 5 to 10% of people who receive CPR actually come back to life. But we know there is so much more that can be done. And what's incredible is that the Yale scientists have shown that it can be done in other mammals. And so it's up to us as physicians to now upgrade the treatments and show the world that many millions of people can be saved. So I don't think it is fringe. I think that, but what you highlight is that, of course, there are many doctors who don't know these things. Mm. And so they assess their judgments based upon the knowledge that they have that CPR doesn't work. They say, oh, if a person's been dead for 20 minutes, it's almost pointless to try CPR because they never come back. And that is true. But it's like saying to somebody who's only ever seen, let's say, a car from the 1920s, a Model T Ford, which was revolutionary in its time, and is now trying to, you know, drive up a hill in the middle of a snowstorm, and they've never seen a 4x4. They've never seen that such a thing is possible. What we're saying is medicine has reached a point in which we now have the 4x4 capabilities, and we can go up much higher hills and more difficult challenges and overcome them. But we need to implement it.
Okay, so I mean, this sounds very, very important work. What are the next steps in your research, and what are there other clinicians and other centers working alongside you to try and push this forward? Because this is, you know, you're talking about reversing what we typically call death. I mean, what is your study design, and what further steps do you need before we establish an emergency response center in every major city that uses one of these ECMO machines and this cocktail of drugs to resuscitate people when they've died?
Yeah, there are many others. For example, there are a group of German physicians who've actually developed a machine that's very similar to what the Yale scientists used. And it's basically one of these heart-lung bypass machines, but it's importantly, it combines it with a cocktail of brain-preserving medications. And they've already been using it in humans, and they've published a study where they took 69 people who had received CPR, but CPR had failed to start their hearts, and they would have been declared dead. But instead of letting them be declared dead, they connected them up to this particular device with a cocktail of drugs, and they were able to restore life to almost 50% of those people, which is incredible.
They show no major brain or heart damage?
Most of them did not have brain damage. Most of them recovered neurologically or with respect to their brain, which is very important. So yes, there are groups of us who understand this and are trying to implement it. I am working with my colleagues in my institution to now implement an upgraded version of resuscitation. We have been using cocktails of brain-preserving medications since 2019, and we found that it doubled the survival in our patients. So this is something that is active and being fostered.
How soon, you know, looking at the timelines and the work that you're doing, is it likely that we would see this in a clinical setting?
As I say, we're working on this. We're hoping to start within less than a year, and others will hopefully upgrade their treatments as well, and they can follow the lead and do that.
I wanted to finish off talking with you because as an expert in resuscitation, you often are dealing with people who have gone through the barrier of what, you know, they would have expected to be death and then have come back, flatlining and beyond. And I'm wondering, in the last few years, do any of the stories or experiences of patients stand out to you in terms of what they said they felt or experienced while they were technically dead?
Well, one of the remarkable things that happens when people die is that most activities shut down. But incredibly, in this hibernation state where the brain becomes dysfunctional, it actually releases activities that are helpful to the person. So, for example, the body tries to initiate mechanisms to save itself, and it expresses genes that repair any damage. At the same time, what seems to happen is that we call this disinhibition. In other words, you get activation of dormant pathways. What this seems to do is that it enables a person who's gone through death to suddenly access huge amounts of their own consciousness. So from the perspective of doctors like me, they seem to be dead and lifeless. But internally, those people describe themselves as having more lucid consciousness, a higher, sharper sense of awareness. And then they describe incredibly feeling that they separate from themselves. They're watching doctors and nurses save them, but they're getting information almost like a field. It's almost like they get information in 360 degrees all over, both what was being said, what was being done. And then what's really remarkable is the person who's now in this gray zone of death, you know, death and just beyond, suddenly starts to reevaluate their entire life. Everything that they've done is re-experienced. Every interaction, every thought, every intention that they've had is re-experienced, analyzed at the same time, almost like millions of sets of data. But they analyze everything they've done purely from the perspective of morality and ethics. And they come to learn that their life had had more purpose and meaning than simple social measures of success that they had been engaged with. And that's why when they come back and they are more altruistic, they're transformed, they try to find a deeper purpose and meaning to life.
Oh man, I'm not looking forward to dying. I'm already someone who's laden with guilt for the mistakes I've made in the past. So just adding that on, a little kick of spice at the end, I'm not looking forward to that.
But I think, you know, you have to realize that this experience is actually a highly educational experience. So people relive everything that they've done, but they also relive how other people felt during their interactions. And so sometimes the experience, of course, leads to a lot of embarrassment when people look at their errors and how they've conducted themselves. But at the same time, incredible amounts of joy where they've helped others and been of assistance. But either way, what comes out of it is a highly positive experience. It's a learning experience. By positive, I mean, even if it was painful, they've learned something from it. In the same way that you and I may have had hardships in life, but when we look back and we've learned something, we use it to progress. So there is a deep recognition that every moment, every action, every intention counts. And that's why when they come back, they try to change the way they were. And as one person said, in his experience, he recognized that he had failed as a human being. But he said, at least when they gave me a second chance, I wanted to go back at least and say I got a C-. And that's the transformative effect of the experience.
Wow. Sam Parnia is the author of Lucid Dying, the new science revolutionizing how we understand life and death. Sam, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was mad, wasn't it?
Incredible.
Absolutely mental.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it when I was talking to him for the research call. I was like, there must be, what's the catch? Like, what's the catch? And I remember, I asked him, like, you know when you hear about, we're taking a mission to Europa, but it's not going to happen for 20 years. And you're like, that's the most important thing in astrobiology. Why aren't they doing that now? This is like way more important.
Yeah.
It's like, why isn't this in every hospital in every city in the world?
You know, I have a lot of chats with sort of innovators and and, you know, researchers in medical settings. And there's so much of that stuff. Like, why aren't we doing that right now? And it there's a lot of different reasons, but it seems like, you know, this is obviously access to these ECMO machines is obviously limited. You know, a definitive paradigm of what we should do and what drugs we should do, that hasn't been figured out yet. So it's understandable that we haven't got a protocol for saving someone's life, but it is crazy that CPR is all we've got. And yeah. CPR is awful for loads of reasons, but it is for the 10% or 5%, you know, worthwhile doing anyway. But it seems like hooking someone up to one of these heart lung bypass machines, that's, I'm like, I'm gonna have a little bracelet saying ECMO me up.
I was saying that. I was like, can I get an organ donor card going, this is what you do?
Little instructions.
And then if that doesn't work, then you can have my organs. Yeah,
exactly. Have you tried?
Yeah.
All right, fine, you can take my lungs.
Yeah.
Very good. I love those pieces. That's what I love about this program, is every once in a while you get someone and you're like, ah. Right. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Very good.
Good. Are you using ChatGPT to write any of my research briefs?
No.
You're not?
No, the listeners must know that, surprisingly, even though I absolutely love science, I'm sort of a bit of a technological Luddite. Like, I'm the type of person who freaks out when my phone has a software update. I'm like, no, I just got used to the slightly different format. So I should be using it, you're right. But he's slow.
He's one of those people who stabs the keyboard one by one with his fingers when he types.
Mona, my phone's not working.
But do you know, like, it is something like, you know, this app I use called Fathom. Man, you know, just having a conversation with somebody and then it gives you all the notes and it gets rid of the stuff where you say, oh, how are the kids? You know, all that sort of nonsense stuff. It just gets rid of all that and just tells you what you need to know from the course. Amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah, we're getting...
I need to go to your course.
It's not. That's overcooking it. I didn't tell him to say that, but I feel like you felt you needed to say that. That's weird. Don't do that.
I just wanted to embarrass
him. Don't fucking... Yeah. But you should. Okay, shut up, Jonathan. All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week. Joe, we were talking about BMI and, you know, as a measure of obesity and so on. And someone says, I saw a video listing of all the Olympic athletes who are deemed to be obese by BMI, showing how crude, inaccurate and ridiculous BMI can be. Yeah, you keep hearing this over and over again, don't you, that BMI is just a really bad way of measuring it. And LeBron James is supposedly, you know, obese or nearly obese, according to his BMI.
Yeah, I remember when I was playing football as well, like we got our BMIs checked and I was the fittest I've ever been in my entire life. And I was categorized as slightly overweight. So it's, I think athletes especially, because they're big, they've got a bit of muscle mass on them, it seems to, for some reason, put them higher than they should be. Mm. They're clearly not obese.
No. Not by my measure, anyway. We were talking about sweating neutrinos, and someone had asked about it, and we were like, nah, we don't sweat neutrinos. But clearly we had just forgotten what was said, because we do. We corrected this in the last podcast. We talked about it. Liam was texting in. He says, so Jonathan, I am creating particles that will travel forever through space. Am I leaving a fingerprint on the universe? You are indeed, Liam. And by being featured on the podcast, even more so. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producing, and on sound, Hugo da Silva. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday, where we're going to be talking about magic mushrooms and speaking to a researcher who made his volunteers trip balls for science. That'll be fun. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.